You are listening to Alchemy Pod, ramsdigital.com sponsored podcast.
This article is presented as a historical document. Many of the details and individuals mentioned in the article have passed on or are no longer active, or some of the details were incorrect. This article,
A French Alchemical Romance and Adventure,
has historical value as a window into alchemy in the 1980s.
A French Alchemical Romance and Adventure by Hans Nitzel, September 22nd, 1986. Since I promised many to recount to them the circumstances of my trip to France and sojourn with the filiation Sol Zarif, I set down this chronicle of the salient events of the trip, how it came to be, and the portent for the future. It started with a letter from a correspondent, Signor José Anis, in Lisbon, Portugal. In a letter, he mentioned the filiation, and that he understood that they had published an outstanding book on alchemy, in French to be sure, but that I should look into it. I needed no further encouragement. Having secured their address, I wrote the affiliation, and inquired about the book by one Sol Zarif. Simultaneously, I wrote to a few other organizations in France concerning their publications. I did not realize until later that these groups were publishing the Sol Zarif material as written as magazine articles. In particular, were the Verte Indudite and Tempe Chimique. Both had material written by Sol Zarif, not contained in his book. I received a notice from the affiliation with an inquiry as how I came to learn of the group, and the book, and the master, for they called him, Sol Zarif, that they were a private group, and that the book was privately published and not generally available to the public at large. If I desired more information, I could write to a certain Madame Rouge in Clermont-Ferrand for further information, making formal requests for this data. This I did, and first received a letter in French that described in broad terms the purpose of the book and some indication of its content and some indication of the author, Sol Zarif. Immediately thereafter, I received a phone call from Montreal from a Camille Corderi, who introduced himself as a member of the affiliation. And would I have time to talk? Would I? Sure. He asked me several questions about if I felt that more alchemical knowledge was being made available, and if I had noticed that much of this knowledge was now coming from France. Affirmative. He confirmed a suspicion I had that the Soviets had taken, or had tried to take, Afghanistan because of the alchemical center in Nuristan. This, of course, made me warm up to the man. He talked about the book at length and its contents. I was impressed. He asked about my work in the lab, my work with Rams and so forth. He asked if I was interested in the book. My comments about the bear's personal habits in the woods died on my lips due to the great modesty. I simply grunted, "Shoot, yeah!" He thereon asked if I would write him a letter outlining my alchemical activities and requesting the right to procure a copy of the book and the right to get it translated, as I read almost no French. I agreed, and he promised to hand-carry the letter to France and present it to the master. He also suggested translating L'Alchimie Explicite sur ses textes classiques and Le Laboratoire Alchemique by Eugène Cancellet and Atorine, respectively. He told me both these books were very revealing and worthy of the Rams' treatment. He agreed to purchase the two books on my behalf and send them to me. He did, and I have them in my library now, awaiting further action. At this time, I was under a lot of stress. The business was not going very well due to the oil crisis, and I was really hustling, trying to keep things going. Well, in late July in 1986, I got a letter from France, from the filiation. It said, in fine, due to my communications with Camille Corderi, the filiation would like, no, the master would like, to meet me on the native soil of the filiation. Once I arrived, I would understand why the trip across the Atlantic was necessary. So, if I could pick a day between August the 3rd and 14th, they would arrange for a rendezvous. Well, sir, several questions popped into my mind. First, who would pay for the trip? Although I suspected I already knew this answer, how long would I be there? What would be the purpose of the trip? And did the fact that I spoke virtually no French mean anything? Phew, if I was going to haul off to Clermont-Ferrand, wherever that was, I needed a little reassuring, no? So I wrote this letter off in haste. I also had several personal problems, like how could I get off from work for this escapade? How could I possibly justify spending all the money when things were, well, cash flow slim, and so on? While awaiting a reply from France, I discussed this with a good friend who had some interest in the occult, not in alchemy. A genuine interest, as can be seen. My friend said,
I think you should go. There could be many implications.
In my own sweet manner, I asked if he was going to buy me a round-trip ticket to France. He replied,
well, if you don't mind going tourist class.
I admitted I wouldn't mind. Seems he had accrued a lot of mileage under his American Airlines advance plan and was willing to let me cash one in for a round-tripper. Phew! And he booted in discount tickets for Sheraton Hotel and a week of free car rental. Wow! I graciously accepted. Other problems were solved by the universe, which seems bent on getting me there. My job terminated. An inquiry for a speaking engagement augmented by a sale of a large order of Rams material. Voila, as they say. I now had the time and some spending money as well. With no further ado, I started making arrangements, getting the ticket, calling Madame Rouge, etc., etc. Everything, as it turned out, got down to squeaking in and in-the-nick-of-time situations. The tickets required a certain amount of time to process, not enough time, through the regular channel, as it turned out, for me to make it. So, with the help of some friends, we got some inside data and managed to pick up the tickets, an impossibility, I was told, the day before I would have to leave, if I was able to spend at least 5 days or so with the affiliation. We did it. Also, a call to Madame Rouge revealed I was quite lucky in catching her as she was about to join the filiation in their camp in the woods, where there was no phone. Wow! Now Madame Rouge speaks okay French, except when she gets excited, which is about 1 minute into any series of communications. I asked her to hang loose, and I called Natalie in Colorado, a French translator. I explained to Natalie what I wanted and had her call Madame Rouge with my message as to what I wanted done. Specifically, this was to have Camille call me. He is fluent in English and French, so we could iron out details. The Thursday night prior to my leaving, the next Tuesday. He called at 4 a.m., and the conversation was something like this. Camille.
Mr. Nitzel?
Yes.
When can you arrive in France?
On Wednesday morning, at 9:45, August 13.
Okay. From Orly, take a cab to Paris, to Gare de Lyon. Take a train to Clermont-Ferrand, where you will change to a train that takes you to Briord. I will meet you at the train station in Briord at 5:45 in the afternoon. Oh, do you have a sleeping bag? I ask because there may not be room in the house for you.
Well, yes.
Good, all right. See you next Wednesday.
Click. Hello? Camille? Hello? Operator? Operator? Hello? Silence reigned supreme, and the die was cast. First thing was the plane had a little tinkering to be done on the electrical system. This caused an hour and a half delay. Realize there is no phone where I can call Camille, and Madame Rouge is now in the camp and not at home. And before I left, a friend from India, Pierre, who had taken up summer residence in Lyon, wrote and said, "Don't bother coming. It will be a waste of time." We made up 10 minutes' time and arrived an hour late, 10:30 a.m., and the train to Clermont-Ferrand was to leave at 12:07 p.m. First, cabby wanted 400 francs to go to the Gare de Lyon.
"Trente,"
I said. "Too much, I hope." I got a guy who would go there for 100 francs, the going rate. "Hit it, son.
Hit it."
We arrived and I was schleppin' two suitcases, one with my sleeping bag in it, and a utultum hanging around my neck. I mean, we were talking weight there. At the train station, I huffed and puffed to the information desk, where they, it turned out, spoke English. In the queue rotation, I came up and panted, "I need a ticket to Clermont-Ferrand, where..."
"I..."
he said. "I..."
"Oui, I..."
And he pointed out to the great spaces. I espied cruets, or tickets counter, that had a letter A-M lit up on them. I ran to I, and no one home. I ran back to the information counter and impatiently awaited my turn. It was now around 11:30 a.m. I said, "There is no one at I," he said.
10 minutes.
Ah, I hang out for 10 minutes. No sign of life. It was getting to the 11:45. I ran back. "For God's sake, where else can I get a billet to Clermont-Ferrand?"
"Any ticket window,"
quoted he. "But I whined, you told me I..."
"Train leaves on track I. You can buy a ticket at any window, Roy."
I huffed to a window and the clock spun inexorably on. If I miss the train, no way I can call and explain I am on a later train, right? Right. This is the big one. I explained to the chap in front of me using my newly bought French-English-French dictionary. He was sympathetic, but not enough to let me go ahead. In fact, he wrote a check for his ticket and spent some time fetching suitable ID. God, I finally bellied up to the ticket window, and in my best French croaked, "Un bel pour Clermont-Ferrand, première classe, s'il vous plaît," or something like that. Ticket in hand, I sped for track I. My nervous eye saw a clock. It was noon straight up, 7 minutes to go before the choo-choo went bye-bye without me. Track I was, of course, at the far end, with my suitcases causing me to weave like a drunken gorilla in my travel bag, swinging rankishly from side to side. I hoofed it to track I. One train, so no decisions to make. I jumped on. It started off. Now. I should mention that before I left, I made a reservation for Tuesday night at the Sheraton Montparnasse at $160 a night in Paris. I also wrote friends in Switzerland, Belgium, France, Paris, Pierre in Lyon, who I wished very much to meet, Andure, Italy, Spain, Germany, Norway, and Portugal. I invited all to meet me in Paris at the Sheraton, and we could get together, have dinner, and generally groove on one another's presences. As the train slicked its way out of Gare de Lyon, I slumped in a chair trying to regain my breath and slow my beating heart. I started to wonder how I could be so stupid as to do this. I could be home slipping into a nice dry martini, and here I am huffing and puffing my way to some unknown destination. The conductor's harumph startled me, and he handed over the ticket. He said something in French like, I couldn't get.
"J'ai Amérique, j'ai la..."
"Comprendez pas," said I.
"First class,"
he said. "This is first class ticket," I asked.
"Ticket, yes, class, first. This coach is second class."
Oh, I trudged on into the night, at least to the next car. I looked at the ticket, computer generated. It said, Clermont-Ferrand via Nevis. Via Nevis? Did that mean I had to change Nevis? Oh, shoot. Well, I found a woman who knew enough English to make her dangerous. And between her and my trusty dictionary, we concluded this train went straight through to Briord. In fact, she was going out of Briord. So just stick along. All right, at Clermont-Ferrand. We realized that, in my haste, I had not specified Brion. Oh no. So, if Clermont Ferrand, I had to schlep my bags to a ticket counter to get a ticket. Incidentally, I had been told quite incorrectly that everything in France was cheap due to the superior worth of the dollar. Ha ha! Accordingly, I went to Dieppe-Pirard and purchased only 1,000 francs worth of French currency. A mistake. By the time I bought the Brion leg of the ticket, I had spent 500 of my 1,000 francs, and a week to go, I felt queasy again. Then I couldn't find my way back to the lady who was sponsoring me. Too many passageways. I ran back and forth and finally found her. She motioned me to get on the train. It lurched forward. As I swung suitcases aboard and I jumped, I noticed the terminal said that this train was going to Nîmes. I nearly had a stroke. I hurried through my dictionary and inquired of the lady.
Oh yes, this train was going to Nîmes.
Where she was in fact going. But, I thought this was the train to Brion.
Oh yes, it was going to Brion.
But, which is it? Nîmes or Brion?
Both.
She said firmly. I suddenly realized it must stop at Brion on the way to Nîmes. The case. I sat down and the lady next to me started a conversation.
Junior Brion?
She shrugged and stared out the window. The lady, a third one next to me, said,
next stop is Brion.
Ah! As we pulled into Little Jerkwater Town, the conductor clearly announced,
avant.
I looked at the lady. She grabbed her schedule, looked at it, at the sign coming into view, which said, avant, and shrugged her shoulders and stared out the window. My first lady came in shortly and said,
next stop is Brion.
Bonne chance. Yeah. Next stop was Brion, and I disembarked, walked to the station house. It was 5:45. And deserted. This, of course, set my heart racing. Was this not the right place, the right day, the right, for God's sake, country? And why wasn't I home sipping on a nice dry martini? I flopped into a bench and decided I could do no more than wait. After 10 minutes, a young, bearded man came in. He looked around, saw me and said,
Monsieur Nitzel?
Yes. Oh, yes, that's me, I said. Quite calmly. It was Camel, of course. He led me to the car and we drove out of Brion and into La Capelle-Lorette, a lovely tiny French village. At a 3-story stone building encompassing many acres of land, we opened a gate and drove in. I saw many tents and cars. The cars had license plates from places other than France. Camel introduced me to some people, and one, George, spoke German, so we got along pretty well with broken German and dictionary French. I was then introduced to Madame Dutry, one of the incorruptibles. These are 5 women Sorcerer has personally trained. This lady was of Vietnamese extraction. When introduced, I said, Comme Elus Nuva, or something. She turned to Camel and said a lot of verbs to him. Camel explained that she felt that such comments were inappropriate for this type of place. Uh-oh. I explained to Camel that in addition to that, bonjour was the only other French phrase I had readily committed to memory. He suggested I limit myself to bonjour. At least to her. I found out that this building was strictly for women and children, the wives of male alchemists who did not wish to participate in the rigors of alchemical camp life, or just had no great interest in alchemy anyway. I met one or two and had a pleasant, if difficult, conversation. The kids, once they knew I spoke no French, had fun with me anyway. They continuously speaking French, intuiting I would divine their meaning. And so I did. And so they did. Camel then started to pack a little Renault station wagon in which he had come with food. He ran a shuttle 3 times a day from this house to the camp, bringing the appropriate meal. This one was to be dinner, and I was to have my first meal with the alchemists. We departed and passed through some lovely meadows, then overlooked valleys formed by the volcanous subsistence. The view was spectacular, past old windmills, and finally came to a rutted road that was to lead down 1,000 meters to the valley floor below, and down we went. At the base, Kamal drove to a shelter, rough, but expertly made from plastic sheets covering it all. The sheets had water in them, and they acted as air conditioners during the day, the evaporating water keeping all remarkably cool. Half rounds constituted benches for the tables, all sawn from local timber and lashed together. A remarkable job, I thought. Kamel's arrival always, as I was to learn, brought the men, like Pavlov's dogs. And they came, and preparations for the evening meal were underway. A tin plate, plastic bowl, and a cup and a fork and spoon were secured for me. Soon we assembled, standing at the tables. We joined hands in prayer, and the master then arrived. He led all in a very Catholic-orientated ritual. We then sat. I wish the half round had been placed with the flat side up. The dining room attendants started to serve. First wine, a bottle per each four diners, then the customary buttered rough bread, then the meal. I might as well sit down here in one fell swoop what meal times were like in general, so not to repeat myself. First of all, I was amazed at how delicious everything was, and there was always plenty to eat and drink. Every morning, the wooden box of buttered peasant-like corn rye bread appeared, as did jars of honey and various local jams. Pitchers of cold fresh milk were passed. Boxes of muesli, a sort of granola, was available, and usually, but not always, some fresh fruit, melons, plums, of which I have become inordinately fond, pears, peaches, etc. Some mornings there was cheese, usually a light brie, and always tom. I brought home a wheel of this lovely fromage. There was usually a salad with a marvellous dressing made from malt, oil, and vinegar and spices, always vegetables, and even a simple dish of haricots were cooked lovingly with butter, garlic, and spices. A culinary wonder. Entrees were varied and delicious. Once it was a rough pâté en croûte, once marinated lamb chops, grillade, once brown rice with a sort of hash on it. Great. One night, Nadia, an Indian-German girl, made some Indian dishes. Super. And one night, Sai, they had brought out what looked like pizza pies without topping. There were actually huge shortbread cookies, and they ladled a custard on it and covered it with freshest, largest raspberries man has ever seen. Merci. Well, you have the idea now. The first night, it was a question and answer time. I was the answeree, and everyone else had a whack at asking questions. When one chap asked, and he was Italian, there being Italians, Belgians, Colombians, Portuguese, and one Yankee.
You write people all over the world, yes?
Yes, I said.
Have you ever written to an Italian named Luigi Bernacchi?
I said, why yes, for years, but we have never met.
I am Luigi,
he said. Another chap from Lisbon proved to be the best friend of the man who first told me about Sola Zarif. One fellow wanted to know my opinion of Western imperialism encroaching into Europe. Say what, sucker? Sola Zarif, yes, he was present, indicated this was an inappropriate question for this forum. Well, yeah. Sola Zarif announced we should celebrate my arrival by passing out some cigars, which he proceeded to do. He asked if I wanted one. He puffed away. I said, no, I don't smoke, but in honour of this auspicious occasion, I would take a puff of his. While he roared with delight, once my statement had been translated, there was a burst of applause. Sola Zarif came over and asked through the interpreter, if I thought it strange for an adept to smoke and drink. I replied in German, as I was told he spoke that language. Not at all. In fact, I like a little toddy for my body, now and then myself. He roared, ran to get a bottle of Mayville, a rather potent little drink made from tiny plums, and another burst of applause. Then he asked if I thought it strange to see some of the brother alchemists wearing uniforms, sort of belted sheaths they wore. I said, being of German extraction, I am not only used to uniforms, but put on armbands and boots when no one is looking. I wasn't sure if my subtle humour would be appreciated, but a tremendous burst of applause and laughter. They loved me in Sheboygan, Mum. And so it went on until 9:30. As per usual, we gathered around a roaring bonfire to listen to the master talk. The first night, Sol Zarif allowed any questions to be asked. I asked about his master. This was a Russian priest, Frater Michel, who came to France to teach Sol Zarif alchemy. After a few years, he returned to Russia, to Siad, with the forces of light. Last they heard, he had been put in a gulag, not knowing if this was by plan or simply the Soviets' way of saying they didn't like light. It was asked how he came to be an adept. Sol Zarif responded that he was once a plain old struggling alchemist. However, he had a visit from extraterrestrials. Following this, and a subsequent encounter, he was transformed into an adept. He also discoursed on how positive he was that the Soviets were going, within 1 year,
take over all of France.
Now, I thought this was a paranoia at its finest. I voiced my objection that this was not possible. He asked,
who would stop the Soviets
if they did indeed try this? I replied, well, the USA. I was asked where we were when Hungary, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Lithuania, etc., fell. I said, well, this is different. France is a NATO country.
Not so,
it was pointed out.
There had been an assassination attempt on the life of Charles de Gaulle, CIA working with a NATO chap. De Gaulle felt a little blue about being shot at by an ally and threw them out, so they aren't NATO.
It was pointed out to me that there was some
10,000 KGB agents in France.
They are called sleeping agents. Sleeping because they are keeping a low profile, working, teaching, being regular neighbors. However, when Russia will make a move, they will get the word and do whatever it is they are scheduled to do, like sabotage, disrupt power, etc. Well, after listening to some compelling arguments about this, I was forced to conclude the possibility, absurd as it seems, exists. Other Europeans agreed. I mean, Russia's going into Afghanistan sounds fairly absurd, doesn't it? A friend in Norway assures me that the Soviets have been harassing Sweden and Norway for some time, hoping to make them take some step that can be construed as warlike, and then retaliate by moving in. Remember the Russian submarine a few years ago detected in Malmö harbour in Sweden? A classical example. Turns out the small tractor-treading Russian subs have been detected off the coast of Japan and in the fjords of Norway. Frightening. I was asked,
in various occult factions or groups in the USA, are constantly at war with one another?
I replied, no. In fact, as far as I can determine, I am certainly no expert. They pretty much cooperate with one another. This was met with surprise. Turns out, French groups, be they Masons, Rosicrucians, or what have you, are of the opinion if you aren't one of them, you are the enemy. I was surprised at this until Sol Zarif reinforced this by pointing out there had been two assassination attempts on him, the last one by four men with machine pistols. He had been hit, he had a .45 automatic with him, and fired back, wounding two. Sol Zarif is the master of martial arts, Zen archery, and apparently the Colt .45. He kept an AK-47 in his tent at night. Well, at 10:30, we turned in. I was assigned a tent, but had bought my own sleeping bag. I slept extremely well, having picked a handful of raspberries that grew in abundance as a late snack. The air was now very cool, but sweet-smelling and pleasant.
This is Alchemy Pod.
At 8 a.m., a drummer beat a tattoo to wake all and in sundry. The stream that ran nearby provided icy cold water as an aid to wake up. No one dared bathe in it. Brrr. Few men shaved. The toilet was any place in the bushes, the official bathroom, and there were both ladies and gentlemen, was a hole in the ground with a wooden shed around it to provide a modicum of modesty. The path leading to these had, as you went forward, a bush with a string attached. If the string stretched across the path, the WC was occupied. Lovely. This day, I was shown around and was very impressed with what I saw. First, they had found clay and built a kiln using the clay as a cover, which they baked. Then they built a potter's wheel from wood. They threw the clay on the wheel, making crucibles, retorts, dishes, and the like. These were fired in the kiln, and a hell of a good job at that. They built two furnaces, each one having either a pump-type bellows or holes in the structure by which, using hoses, one could puff into the thing to increase the heat. There was, on the premises, an antimony mine. I crawled into the entrance, donned a hard hat, complete with acetylene miner's lamp, and with hammer and chisel, worked in the mine for a few hours. Quite an experience. The stream had a tributary, which went through a different section of the mine, and it washed out chunks of antimony. So another task was to filter the stream, searching for bits and pieces of antimony. They found plenty, high-grade ore at that. The antimony was ground in a small metal mortar and pestle that Solar Zarif had made. He had some devices for sale. This is one, and a thing of beauty it is. This was purged of sulphur in one of the furnaces. In the other, iron, tartar, and nitre were added to purify the antimony, the molten metals being poured into a metal cone, also made by Solar Zarif. We gathered juniper berries, pine, and achille, maybe a plant called Thousand Flowers. In the morning, dew was gathered by dragging sheets on the ground. Inquired if this did not ground the dew. Answer,
no.
When I pointed out that Mutus Liber shows the sheets raised on stakes, I was told
the sheets in those days were often silk or other expensive cloth, and they did not want to get them dirty.
The flowers and berries he gathered and mashed were covered with the dew. The idea, and here is a little alchemy goodie for you, is that instead of purifying the plant, making wine, a tedious process, the dew is macerated with the plant for a week or so, and then it is distilled. The first fraction coming over will be dew and the mercury of the plant. Then one can add more dew, and using now suitable apparatus, distill off the sulphur or essential oil. This was a beautiful blue color due to the juniper. Solar Zarif later made a combination of the salt laboriously calcined over a wood fire, oil, and dew-mercury combination. He poured this into the herbal infusion one morning. Every morning, the hot beverage was a herbal infusion. Once in a while, they had instant coffee in addition. This, of course, was a medicine and was designed to safeguard health for the camp. And there was 50 of us. As you have guessed, one of the main purposes of this alchemical encampment was to teach one that even though the sources of glassware, chemicals, hot plates, and the like go away, as when the Russians might take over, one can still be an alchemist and get what one needs from nature, just like the ancients did. No, not as a convenience to be sure, but you can still operate in a tightened environment, as we did. Oh, Solar Zarif also recommended, as we did, rolling naked in the morning dew. This will give you energy. Actually, I needed all the sleep I could get, so I only did it one morning. And yes, there were women as well as men in the camp. Modesty rolled down the embankment into the WC. Now, that night, even though we got drummed out of bed at 8 a.m., I was up rapping until midnight and felt not a bit tired. Woke up bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, too. Was it the dew? I think so. So there is another little goodie for you. Of course, this needs to be done, and sure you can wear a bathing suit when you roll on your lawn past your neighbor's window, Before the sun hits the dew, the sun will start to dissipate the energy if it shines on it. One day, the village celebrated the feast of Assumption of the Virgin Mary. We were given leave by Sol Zarif to sit in and had been invited by the local priests to attend Mass. Armed with my trusty dictionary, I accepted a ride to town and wandered in. They had a local brass band that did a little parade down the main street of the village, La Chaumes-Lorette, to the square where they proceeded to belt out some pop hits, circa 1900. People danced in the streets, so did I. Some sweet young thing grabbed hold of me, or was it the other way round? No matter. The smell of French cooking permeated the air and set my gastric juices bubbling. A nearby set of concessions and rides found me a Mergers cellar. This is a North African sausage surrounded by chunks of French bread and swathed in some snappy mustard. Then the pastries and a Napoleon, followed by an eclair. Just sampling the local goodies. At this point, I ran into Jackie Bonneau, his wife, Audrey, and he were at the camp, and they spoke English. I invited Jackie to the local bistro for a drink. He ordered for us panache. This is a mixture of third lemonade and filled with beer. I did not think I would enjoy such a combination, but it was pretty good. Jackie asked me what I was planning to do after the camp broke up. I told him I had made a reservation at the Paris Montparnasse Hotel for Tuesday and wanted to go there to meet friends. I'd written many alchemist friends in Europe to meet me there. Also, I wanted very much to visit Pierre Monnieu near Lyon, but did not know how to contact him. He suggested I go home with him and Audrey to their home near Rennes. Paris was less than an hour train ride away, and I could easily get there when I wanted to. Since they had a car, I would not have to travel by train for 6 hours. I joyfully agreed. At the camp, Stefan Kroniewski, who also spoke English, invited me to spend time with him and his wife in their Parisian apartment. Unfortunately, they had to be out of town until the day I was slated to return to the States, some other time. That afternoon, I met with Madame Tutrine. She and Camille and Dominique, their publisher, talked to me about the book Sol Zarif had written, and which was one of my reasons for coming to France. Camille had already told me about the contents of the book. Sol Zarif gave techniques of becoming in tune with the matter the alchemists worked with, how to make the vessels in the correct shape so that they actually work during an operation, etc., etc. I was anxious to get the book. At this meeting, it was agreed that I take the book and see if I can get it translated into English. Seems they are as eager as I am to see it translated. However, they were adamant in my finding that the right person, preferably someone with a feel, if not understanding of alchemy. This effort will probably represent the last work I do with respect to alchemical translation. If my lady, who has done so much magnificent work already, will consent to do this one last item, it will be done extremely well, as she is superb. A master of French and German, and is quite in tune with alchemy due to certain personal experiences. So I trundled La Introitus Lapide Philosophorum home with me, and will soon start to see if, in fact, I can arrange to get this tome translated. Now the affiliation also suggested two other items, one by Cancellet and one by Atelier, to be translated, but these will be of lesser priority than Sol Zarif's book. On the last day, it was clean-up time. Everything was dismantled, disassembled, and everything restored to the condition as when we arrived. The idea was to let it look like no one had been there. Furnaces, kilns, wheels, etc., all were taken down. What was done with the heavy logs used to build the eating place, I am not sure, but when done, it was very difficult to tell anyone had been there. Following the noonday meal of haricot vert, comte d'Agneau, and fresh framboise and cream, Sol Zarif took a sort of medallion. He cut it into 4 parts, gave 1/4 to the Italians, 1 to the Portuguese, Dr. Estefan de la Miranda, with whom I had become very friendly, 1 to the French, and one to me as a mark of brotherhood and fraternity. He told me this metal was transmuted from tin to silver, and if I wished, I could have it tested. In any event, a nice gesture. He told me he would like to come to Texas to join the Sweetwater Rattlesnake Roundup. I told him to come on, that he could stay with me and he could transmute a little more tin into silver. He bellowed with approval, has a lovely sense of humor. Finally, he may just do that, as he would like to consider starting an American branch of the affiliation. I told him to holler when he was ready. We made our farewells, and Audrey and I started walking up the hill. Jackie's Renault was a little puny, and he didn't want to go up the rutted road with all the people and all the suitcases. So we left the suitcases and started the 1,000-meter hike. The air is thin there, folks. In less than 100 meters, I was huffing and puffing. Audrey, bless her heart, suggested we stop to catch our breath. Yeah, after 5 or 6 of these, and we were close to the summit, and it was also quite hot. Just as I thought I would drop from exhaustion, Jackie came wheeling by and picked us up. Phew. It was about a 6-hour drive to Buchy, where the Bonneurs lived. So I was treated to more French countryside views. In southern France, most of the buildings have red-tiled roofs, just like LA, or Spain, I suppose. Now, the French like to drive at 130 kilometers per hour, about 2 feet from the person in front. Outside Clermont-Ferrand, I ran into a serious traffic problem. Seems a cyclone had struck an hour before us. We found it killed 54 people, wiped out a trailer camp, and caused considerable structural damage. Much of it we saw, so we got delayed for a fair amount of time. Then freeway construction in Paris caused another further delay. One time, on a hill, Jackie had to hit the brake in an emergency stop. We slid 10 feet sideways. I was unconcerned, merely requesting some toilet paper. I told Jackie and Audrey and Pierre from Borsalis that I was anxious to have a large bowl of ice and some grape soda or orange soda. I'd explained that this was juice de raisin with l'eau over an beurre or something. Grape juice with sparkling water. You know, fruit-flavored soda water? They asked, a little incredulously, if I really liked this sort of thing. You bet, I said, with lots of ice. The ice, you see, is very rare in smaller villages. Well, we stopped to eat about 11 p.m. at a country inn. I went to the WC, and when I returned to the table was a bottle of jus de raisin and a fifth of lemonade, like carbonated water with a squeeze of lemon, and a bowl of ice. I was quite touched by the thoughtfulness and drank it all. Dinner was prefet at 70 francs, about $11. We had salad, melon and port for me, canard from the Bonnets. I had courgettes. They had escargot, many. For dessert, I had Coeur Belle Helene, ice cream and chocolate sauce over a poached hare. Yummy. Then the obligatory plate of various cheeses. A fluffy goat cheese was my favorite, although I managed a little of the Tom and a little of the Brie. Some excellent poulet fume. We were in that region. Washed it down. Not bad for $11. However, everything else, except for this profit dinner, is fairly expensive. The Bonnets live in a house that is 250 years old. Across the street, the farmer kept cows. I introduced myself the next morning on a walk to the cows and offered to conduct a Tupperware party for the ladies that night. They stared mutely at Well, we got to their house. I had to take a shower. We're talking a lot of brown water going down the drain, and a night in a bed with clean sheets, and no drummer in the morning. Ah, Audrey made some wonderful croissants, some confit, beer and molly, and hot coffee. Yeah, man, this camping jazz is all right, but I find I am a creature of comforts, by and large. We spent the day calling the Sheraton Montparnasse to see if I had any messages. None. Seems one chap from Paris has indicated I wrote many European friends to try and meet me in Paris. Was going to the States as I was going to France. Ha! Also, in Spain, Julian and Manuel had set out on a tour of Europe themselves. Uri in Switzerland was busy. Jose in Portugal was in Israel. Jean in France was on vacation, as were most Frenchmen during the month of August, and so on. Well, I managed to find Pierre Mounier in Lyon, who could not make it to Paris, nor I now to Lyon. He actually lives in India, and we had never talked or met, just corresponded. Now we had a nice, satisfying chat on the telephone. In fact, he and the Bonneuls got to talking. With that, I cancelled my hotel in Paris and opted to stay with my newfound friends, Jackie and Audrey, for another day. And it was a delightful time. We talked about alchemy for the most part, and life in France versus the US. Life in general, and of course, books. Jackie has a marvelous library. He gave me a couple of books in English that he had copies of in French. I gave him my personal copy of Golden Chair of Homer, and he gave me a book of the color plates of Splendor Solace. What generous, loving people they are. The next day, they drove me to Rouen. We visited the incredible cathedral. Amazing. The markets, shops, a museum or two, and then back home, where Audrey had made for me some wonderful soup, along with the pâté and other goodies. The next day, she gave me a bag of Queen Claude plums, which I so loved, and put a large rose from her garden in it. I told her roses were my favorite flowers. The next day, after a tearful farewell, Jackie drove me to the train station. I got off at Gare de l'Est and grabbed a cab. He spoke good Italian, but little English. However, he took me under the Arc de Triomphe, down the Champs-Élysées, and to Notre Dame Cathedral. It was pretty whirlwind, all right, but I did get to see some of Paris. It was wonderful, but you know what? I will take the US of A any time. We are just not aware of what we have in our own backyard. Yes, I loved visiting France, as I did England, would go back at the drop of a hat, and mostly because of the many friends I have there. In sum, it was a magical tour, all right. Many things, I feel, were started and remain to gestate before they come to fruition. What are they? I don't really know. I can only feel that there is something. I learned some things, got different viewpoints on many things, and most importantly, met some wonderful people along the way, who are stars in my galaxy of marvelous friends. As a sort of postscript, when I got back, I started my new job with Kentech Services. Jolie had to go into the hospital for 2 days for an angiogram. She has blockages. The bad news. However, the good news is they think they can alleviate some of this via oral medication. We will just have to see. Shortly after, I virtually collapsed. I was down all Labor Day weekend, running 102 plus fever. The next weekend, same thing. What? Not sure, but we figure it was no doubt stress-related. I have been going for 6 months. Up every night for months till 2 a.m., writing and working, translating items, corresponding, etc. Also trying to keep the business going, various other problems that were quite stressful, etc. Then when Jodie announced she had to have an angiogram, well, that might have been the proverbial last straw, and my body caved in. We are both in fine shape as I write this. Jodie is taking care of herself. I've been going to bed at 11 p.m. and getting up at 6:30, even on weekends. So, some physical changes have taken place, in addition to some mental and spiritual ones. What all this is leading to, only time will tell. Anyway, this is a bit lengthy chronicle of my alchemical mystery tour to France. I hope you enjoyed my recounting of it, as much as I have in writing it. Peace and love. NLVX. Hands.
This article was written by Hans Nitzel and read by Andrew Kettle. To support this podcast, visit www.ramsdigital.com.